listener production.
Shares.
Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is the Motley Fool Money Mailbag.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, our very special Sunday Mailbag edition. He's Andrew Page. I'm Scott Phillips. Welcome, Ram. How are you, mate?
I'm very good, sir. How are you?
I'm exceptionally well, thank you very much. Here's the man of straws, of course, the man who runs, who started, whose brainchild was Strawman.com, who actually gets a call out in next week's Good Oil episode. I forgot to mention that to you on Friday,
cool.
Mate. My guest mentioned you.
Oh, favourably, I hope.
Mentioned the company. Yes, I think it was. In passing, unprompted by me, no product placement, no money change. Well, as far as I know, no money change hands. Maybe I should ask you. Maybe there was some sort of subliminal something going on. But you are making waves, mate. You are reaching the masses, and you're doing a wonderful job of it.
Oh, you're very kind.
But tell me exactly what Strawman is again.
We're an investment club, as you well know. but we do it all
but
online.
But not just an investment club. You're a private investment club, I think.
We are a private investment club. Yeah.
You see it in my brain?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah,
all online?
Absolutely,
okay, nice.
We are. We're not trying to. We're sort of going for quality over quantity. So we could probably have 50 million users and that'd be great, but I'd rather sort of the more.
Could you?
Yeah.
Could you really have 50 million
users? Well, maybe not 50 million users. there's plenty of businesses that at the end of the day, you know, it's got to be delivering value to our members, and it's not just metrics that you can quote to a VC.
You are never going to be a dot-com unicorn if you say we don't want more members.
Yeah, but that's cool.
You gotta get with the program, dude. It's got to be world domination. It's got to be, you know, a total addressable market of 84 quadrillion possible users.
Maybe I'm missing a trick, but it's not, you know, I'm not going that way.
I like it, mate. Well done. And of course, you know, the Motley Fool is an investment advisory business that provides investment advice for individual investors. So that's out of the way. We've made our respective bosses happy. I guess you have made Mrs. Page happy by mentioning it. So that you have, to some degree, made your boss happy, and certainly mine is happy that I've mentioned our business as well. Mate, let's move on from gratuitous plugs. Although, actually, I'm going to start off with a gratuitous plug.
Okay.
I haven't for a little while specifically asked for questions for the mailbag. And we've got enough, so we're good. But if you want your question answered, if you've got something that's burning before you get into the content or even after you get into the content, please send us those questions. Now, you can follow us on all the socials, but the best way to get your question answered is to either email it to us at info@fool.com.au. You can hit us up on socials, direct message me at @TMFScottP on Twitter, or the same address on Instagram, or jump onto Facebook and just go to Scott Phillips Money. You can use the Motley Fool's accounts as well, because I run both of those, at least when it comes to the what we call in the trade the organic content. Someone else does the ads, but I do most of the posting. So you'll get us on any of those things. If you've got any questions, comments, feedback, stuff you've always wanted to know, stuff you've never wanted to know but it's just occurred to you, we are the place to come. As I've said regularly over the... Well, almost, it's been 5 years. I think it's been 5 years, this podcast now, mate. I should go back and check. As I said, for those years, the show doesn't exist unless you listen to it and unless we're answering questions that you find interesting. So we'd love to, rather than talk amongst ourselves, to actually be talking to you about the things you care about. So let us know. Disappointingly, Ram, there is a Bitcoin question. So
it's hot right now.
So hot right now. Is that the first time in your life you've been so hot right now?
Much,
because I've never been there. I own $100 worth of Bitcoin, as you know, but I've never been so hot right now.
Well, it's got to be worth more than $100 now, right?
I assume so. Again, I can't sell it, as I've said before. I will find my phone and surreptitiously check my Bitcoin value before we get to that question, so I can tell you. I have no idea what it's worth. But yes, you mentioned to me on Friday. Is it a record price or near record price?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Record?
I'm certainly not going to do a victory lap. I've said repeatedly this thing could drop by 50% tomorrow. I would shrug my shoulders. It could totally happen. It is hyper volatile. So, yeah, it's nice that it's there. It's been there before and fallen away. Who knows what's going to happen in the short term? Anything could happen. But I'm more likely to want to talk about it when it's at a record high. But it's
yeah, funny you didn't mention it for a while. I don't know what happened.
Yeah. Let's not get into it. You're tempting me, but yeah, I'll leave it at that.
Good, because I was going to catch you off if you tried. Yeah. Let's go to the questions we've got from our listeners, mate. The first question is an interesting one. It's from Bottle on Twitter. Bottle refers to me as Phyllis. I'm not sure whether he means Phillips or whether he just decided to call me Phyllis or he likes that. I'm not entirely sure. His hi, Phyllis and Pagey. Bottle, I'm going to assume that's not a criticism. I've got a quick question for the mailbag poddy, Potty is what the cool kids call podcasts, right? Just in case you're wondering. I know those things.
thank you.
Bottle says, is there any website or portal available? You can enter ETF tickers and see if there's a crossover between the two. Keep well, fellas, from Bottle. Bottle, there is. You got to pay for it, and it's by a somewhat competitor of ours, not that we really care too much about that. Morningstar is the business, and apparently it has a thing called a portfolio X-ray, something, something, I don't know, where apparently you can put in the tickers and it will actually spit out that information. So you can. I believe you've got to pay to be a member of Morningstar to get access to it, so feel free to do that if you want to. I'm not going to run down their business. I think they do a good job. I would say to you, you probably don't need it. There are two lots of people. There's always two lots of people in this world, Andrew, depending on whatever topic we're talking about. Some who just need to know, right? They need to know that Amazon.com is 18.4369% of their portfolio and need to know that BHP is 2.589% of their portfolio and so on and so forth. I have to say I own Amazon, given I just mentioned it. By the way, if you want to find my holdings, go to my Twitter profile and click on the link there. It's probably the easiest way rather than me saying it every time. I probably will because it's kind of, I'd rather over-disclose than under. But if you ever are wondering, you can get it there. So they're up there still. I love that. If that's you, go for it. Like, knock yourselves out. Generally speaking, you're kind of going to roughly know what's going on. But here's the other thing. You can't over-allocate your portfolio by adding two lots of the same company, because you're adding more money at the same time, right? So here's the thing. If you buy the NASDAQ ETF with $100 and then you buy another share of the NASDAQ ETF with another $100, Amazon's still the same share, right? You've got two separate transactions. If you buy Amazon, then the S&P 500, your share actually goes down because Amazon's a greater proportion of the NASDAQ ETF than is of the S&P 500 ETF. You've got two lots of it. But I don't know, I'm just going to make it up, mate. Let's say Amazon was 10% of the NASDAQ and 8% of the S&P 500. Mm-hmm. Then the weighting actually goes from 10 to 9. Mm-hmm. So even though you got more of it, you've added more money in total. And so the proportional ownership actually goes down in that circumstance. Now, again, if you had the S&P 500, you add the NASDAQ, of course you would expect it to go up. But it's not like it goes from 8% to 18% because you're not doubling the percentage. You're not adding the percentages together. You're averaging the percentages. Mm. So just worth noting. I mean, I guess at some level you're going, if you bought stuff you weren't sure what you were buying, how much of it you were buying, if you're buying a tech ETF and a cybersecurity ETF and then a e-commerce ETF, I guess it's possible you have the same company three times. But again, even if you did, it'd be the average of those holdings rather than adding them together. And if that kind of doesn't make a whole lot of sense, just think about the dollar values you're adding money. You're not taking the same $100 and dividing that, adding more Amazon with the same money. You're adding more money to all the positions in the second ETF or the third ETF you buy. Mm. Does that make sense, Ram? Have I done a half decent job of explaining it? Can you improve on that?
Yeah, no, I would. All I would add is that I think people, ETFs are great. We always say that they're great. The broad-based index tracking ETFs, that's generally my advice to family and friends, unless you suck up a punishment and you like going, you like being a stock picker.
Indeed.
But you don't need to have 10 ETFs. Like one ETF and you're kind of like super. If you only had one or two ETFs in your portfolio, I'd say you're extremely well diversified, assuming they are some of the broader index tracking ones. So I think Bottle's absolutely right in the sense that they probably want to know what the crossover is so they exactly avoid that scenario of just unnecessarily sort of having two ostensibly different holdings.
Oh, that's true.
But,
okay, yeah.
But am I really actually doing much difference here in terms of my exposure? And that's I would assume that's what they want to know. Don't overthink it. If you decide US tech stocks seem really interesting to me, I'm bullish on all those big names, then buy a NASDAQ one. And then if you want something that gives you a difference, maybe in Asia or something like that, do that. That's perfectly sensible. Yeah. But having the S&P 500 ETF, the NASDAQ ETF, the Tech Leaders ETF, it's kind of unnecessary diversification. Yeah. And they will perform differently, but they probably won't perform massively differently over a meaningful stretch of time. So, yeah, keep it simple.
There's probably no harm in having three separate ones either, Matt, by the way, because as long as the fees are low on all of them, you make it unnecessarily complex, but the complexity is not even that big a deal. Yeah. If I owned three different S&P 500 ETFs, I could probably get one from iShares, one from BetaShares, and one from someone else, Vanguard. I could actually own three of the exact same ETFs, but it wouldn't cost me any because you get charged a percentage of the value. So, go with the cheapest one. But if one's charging me 0.041, 0.051, 0.06%, having all three, as you say, completely useless to add them, but also no real.
Oh yes, yeah,
I wouldn't run away from that either.
Yeah,
right?
But it's just unnecessary in a lot of cases. That's my only point.
I hadn't thought about that angle, mate. So I'm glad you brought it up. It's a really, really good one. In terms of ETFs, if I was going to build an ETF portfolio, I think I'd probably grab an Australian ASX 300 ETF, a US S&P 500 ETF. Maybe an Asia ETF, or I might just go ASX 300 plus a Vanguard Global ETF and be done with it. Mm. If you're going to build a portfolio just of ETFs, how few would you have, mate?
Two or three would probably do me. In fact, so I've mentioned before, I don't invest directly in the US. I own Tesla shares, Amazon shares, Netflix shares through ETFs. So I don't pick it. And I've only got two different types that are in there. It gives me thousands of different companies, hundreds of different companies, So I've felt no need to sort of further diversify within that. Some people prefer very specific sector exposure, theme mm-hmm. exposure, and that kind of. We sort of touched on that kind of stuff before, and that's fine too if you want to go that mm-hmm. way. But again, just have a clear idea of what is it you're setting out to achieve, and how many instruments and securities you kind of need to achieve that, and the fewer the better. More often than not, I would say.
I like that. I think that's a really good point. I wonder if. Yeah, I think fewer is better almost by definition, just because it makes life easier, right? There's just a sense of like, don't overcomplicate, particularly if you are by definition trying to invest in ETFs because you don't want to be involved. The whole idea of actually, you know, then being more involved by trying to pick ETFs is almost the point, right? It's like don't do it. It's only painful. So,
yep.
Mate, let's go to another question. This one's from, I want to say Dylan. Let me double check that. It is from Dylan. Dylan says, where are we? Sorry, I lost it. Here we go. How are we, Scott and Andrew? We are well, Dylan. Thank you for asking. Many thanks for your priceless information and wisdom, as well as entertaining banter. Thank you, mate. Keep up the good work, he says. Question for the podcast, if you wouldn't mind answering. We don't at all, Dylan. Thank you. One can look at the financials of a company, he says, and research it as a whole, and we can decide whether it is a good company to invest in. Look at various metrics such as ratios, discounted cash flow, revenue forecasts, all help give insight into the direction in which the company is headed. My question is this, he says. Despite all of these indicators saying one thing, is it ultimately the market perception of said indicators which moves the share price, not the indicators itself? For example, a company may have a growing earnings per share, but that itself does not directly increase the share price. It's ultimately the perception of this increased EPS which causes more people to invest in it and brings up the share price. If this is the case, are we simply investing in a company which we hope others will one day share a similar view of and thus enable them to invest in it? Should we worry our research is in vain as others may never view the company through the same lens? Thank you both for your time and knowledge from Dylan. I reckon this is one of the best questions we've ever had.
It's an outstanding question.
I love the way he's thought through this entire component, and our listeners know I love behavioral investing, behavioral economics, behavioral psychology generally. And you're exactly right, Dylan. You're saying there's the company and there's the market, and nothing happens unless the market thinks it does. Mm. So are we wasting our time, Ram? Should we not just be trying to guess the market mood changes rather than bothering with the company itself?
Yeah, well, this comes back to sort of knowing what you're doing in terms of having a clear strategy. So if you're trying to invest, and it's not really investing, it's speculating. If you're speculating over a short time frame, and I'd argue that anything less than a year is certainly a pure gamble. You can look at all the metrics in the world. You can understand the business perfectly. You could have gone through a massive deep dive. It doesn't mean the shares won't halve or double. Anything can happen. And Dylan's absolutely right. Price is determined through the interaction of buyers and sellers and whatever they happen to want to pay. And a lot of the time that is influenced just entirely on their sentiment. And sometimes they're in a very optimistic good mood. Sometimes they're very scared in a very pessimistic mood. I'm of the firm view that you just can't predict that. It's too complicated. What are people going to think en masse in 6, 12 months? Even 24 months' time. I don't know. I have no idea. But I do know, and this is that great saying, that in the short term, the market is a voting machine, but in the long term, it is a weighing machine. And what you can say and what you can bank on with extreme high amount of confidence is that if the company delivers long enough, the market will eventually recognize it. And I've always challenged people to find me an example over a five-year period where a company has gone extraordinarily well and the share price hasn't broadly tracked that earnings per share figure. You might find one or two examples where it was just ridiculously valued at the start. But generally speaking, there is so much gravity there that it will drag it up. And even though people might ignore that for a long time, even though you can point to any number of PEs and ratios and rah, 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 who knows what they're going to think. But it will out in the end. The market will recognize it. And that is one of the core skills of an investor, is to weather the storm in between and wait for that to be realized. And everyone says they can, but it's hard. Yeah. It's really hard to sit there on something in 3 years, you know, you're making a loss, everything else is going up, and she's, what am I missing? Like, everything says this is a good company. And yet the market fails to agree with you. You look silly for a long, 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 long time. But that's where the money is made, frankly. And because when it does start to recognize it, well, you're in the ground floor. And we always talk about, you know, long-term average of 10% per annum on the market. Well, it's not that it goes up 10% per year. It could go down 20%, stay flat, and then go up 100%. You know, it's more the destination than the journey. And as long as you've got a clear view on where that destination is, and the path between there and here is an attractive one, then do it. And just unfortunately, there's no easy way of saying it, but you've just got to be sanguine with the ups and downs and the twos and fros and all the insanity that happens in between. Most people can't do it. Most people get really bad returns.
Delicious grin and bear it, isn't it?
You have to.
I'm going to agree with that probably entirely. And I think that's why it's worth being roughly right rather than precisely wrong, right? Because whether the shares are 20, 25 or 30 cents today, if they're eventually $10, it's not going to matter.
Yeah, no difference.
And whether they're $9, $10 or $11 by then also doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
And so will the market ever completely agree with our view of valuation? Probably not, because that's not the game you're playing. You're not saying it needs to be eventually $1.08 per share, otherwise I've made a mistake or shouldn't invest in it. I mean, if you buy at $1.70 waiting for $1.08, well, good luck to you. So that's the other thing, is I wouldn't invest in anything. I thought the range of outcomes was so tiny that I couldn't possibly make a dollar.
Yeah.
To Ram's point, and this is where, honestly, I would say, I've said this before, mate, you said this before, the growth covers a lot of valuation sins. Because if you're buying a company you think can grow at 3% a year and it grows at 2.5%, you might make money, because the range of outcomes, even if the market finally does work out, that growth has been slow but steady. The share price will go up over time on that basis. But you know, the range of outcomes are so tiny, if you get it slightly wrong, you're screwed. If you find it after pay and you said at some point, look, it's probably worth somewhere $5 or $10 and it might get to $120 or so, that's all you needed to know. If you bought it 8 or 10 or 12 and it went to 110, 20 or 30, it really didn't matter. And so that's your broader point, right? Yeah. Eventually the market works it out. It can be super volatile, by the way, and you can spend super long periods. I did some numbers earlier this week, actually. And I'm not getting paid per Amazon mention, by the way, but I did write it about Amazon.
Sure?
Amazon was up threefold in the last 5 years, 110 to $500, give or take. That's not right. Whatever the numbers were.
A butt ton is the technical term.
It was 3.5 times. But if you looked at that, there were 4 distinct time periods. The first time period was about 6 months. The shares were up. No, it wasn't over 5 years. It was over 2.5 years. The shares were up about 80%. Then they went nowhere for a year and a half, up like 3%, I think. And then they went up another 70%. And then the last 12 months, they've gone down 5%. And so you had to live through periods where this hugely overhyped, overpriced stock, everyone's telling you to sell, went nowhere. And you're like, oh my God, they're right. And then it was like a six-month period, went up 70%. Another six-month period went up 80% over that entire 2.5 or 3 years. And so it's just a really, really important thing to know that, to your point, Ram, not only do you have to wait sometimes for it to happen, but it can go the wrong way for long periods of time as well while you wait. And so that's absolutely... So look, Dylan, your question is absolutely right. But over time, the market's not stupid enough that it won't recognize the actual value. You may absolutely, though, for what it's worth, have to wait till the profits come in. So if you're an Amazon shareholder, again, remember the shares went from, I've said this before, 3 to 100, then 100 back to 9, then 9 to 3,000. The shares fell 90% at one point. This is split adjusted. Shares fell 90% at one point, right? While you waited for the business to prove itself. And even though the market was probably wrong to call it $100, we said this on Friday, probably wrong to call it $9 on the way through, may still be wrong at $3,000 the share price is now. But that journey itself, that process you went through, you still had to basically do the hard yards and say, you know, it's down 90%, but I think that this is a good business. I think the market will eventually realize it. And it had, it did and has. But it's a long time to wait and a lot of grief to wait through. And sometimes you may just have to wait till actual profits turn up. The market might hate your idea forever, Tesla is up, was up tenfold in like 2 years, something stupid, Ram. But David Gardner recommended it for one of his servers in the US. It went literally nowhere for 5 years. Literally nowhere. Like dead flat, 5 years.
Well,
until eventually
not dead flat. It was flat from beginning to end, but all in between.
Yeah, there is that. There is that.
Yeah. I hear
you. And then all of a sudden the gains turned up, and that's important. So price does tend to follow value roughly over rough periods of time. You may have to wait. You know, if you buy a super early stage company that's going to discover lithium and mine it on the moon and whatever, people might be skeptical until the very point where there's enough profit to justify the price, and that might be 10 years away. But you've got to. You know, sometimes you've got to wait for that. You can't tell the market your timing. You've got to accept the market's timing. But over time, generally speaking, in almost all cases, you say, mate, price does follow value.
It's a very, again, like so many of our answers, I recognize it as being a very...
It depends.
It's a very unsatisfying one because...
Yeah, totally, right.
I mean, we all love really easy answers and we're sort of saying, it's really complicated.
And to make it easier for
me. And you've got to have sort of long-term view on the economics and profitability of a business and you've got to... It's like, oh, well, I've got to do that. That's really hard. It's super hard. It's super hard. But here's the alternative. The alternative is having a guessing game on market sentiment, and that's harder. So you know there's that wonderful look it up on Wikipedia the Keynesian beauty contest, which describes it perfectly. It's a thought experiment from a different era, which is horribly sexist and not appropriate for our time. But he's basically sort of saying you're the judge of a beauty contest, which are just awful things. But you know, so you've got all these, and again, in the day, it's pretty girls sort of up there, and you've got to judge which one is the prettiest. But he's saying, what if the competition wasn't to judge who you thought was the prettiest? And God, it's such a horrible example, isn't it? But it is the sort of the canonical sort of example from history.
Yep.
Is that what you have to do as a judge is not vote on what you think is the prettiest girl. You have to vote on what other people will think is the prettiest girl.
Yeah.
Now that is a fundamentally different question.
Correct.
And so now you're trying to guess what other people are thinking, and then it's actually it iterates, right? So it's actually, well, now I'm not even thinking what other people think is the prettiest girl, and now I'm thinking what other people think is the prettiest girl, and then I've got to go a layer down and a layer down, and it's phenomenally hard. It's diabolically hard. So yes, while I get that the right answer is a frustrating one, a difficult one, and one that's fraught with risk and danger, the alternative is far riskier, because you tell me what kind of mood Mr. Market is going to be in the short to medium term. No one knows. Yep. No one has ever known. And so it's really easy to give a very simple first level thinking kind of answer that says, oh, you just do this and it all works out. It's well, it's just the overall story is it's very hard, but one is virtually impossible versus one being very difficult. And I'll take the very difficult over the impossible any day.
You haven't exactly sold it, mate, but you're exactly right. Yeah. Let's move on to the next question. This is one. So there was a tweet from my boss's boss, Tom Gardner, the CEO of The Motley Fool. And I'll read you the full section, because then Troy asks us a question at the end, including you. I don't know why he wants your opinion, but apparently he does. Tom Gardner wrote, if the market fell 20% if the market fell 20% in the next year, here are 10 stocks I still wouldn't consider selling now or then. And he mentioned 10 companies. How about yours? I replied, I would sell literally not a single one of my holdings, unless the share market slump was because of an enduring economic or industry obstacle that permanently harmed the long-term potential of those companies. In other words, volatility doesn't matter. If I like Woolies now, I think Woolies is going to be bigger in 10 years' time. Whether the market drops in the meantime, it doesn't matter, which we've said many, many times, Ram. So my answer to Tom was, I wouldn't sell any of my companies at all, because it just doesn't matter, unless the slump was something to do with, there was a factor that was enduring, right? Let's say the market slumped because we ran out of oil. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, maybe that matters. Or the market slumped because the dollar, you know, the Australian government was insolvent. Okay, that kind of matters. So there are times when it might be true. So I said, I wouldn't sell a single one just on volatility alone, because why would you? If you think they're great long-term investments, what happens in the meantime, you just talked about that, doesn't matter.
Mm.
So I said that, and that was all fine. Troy comes back with a great question. He says, Scott and Sage underscore Simeon, your handle, I make this in a question for the podcast format. What 5 shares, if the entire market fell 20%, would you buy?
Mm.
And Troy puts more in brackets to suggest, and he's right, that maybe there are companies we already own we simply buy more of. And I love this question, because there is a a school of thought that if you're an active investor, an interested investor, if you like what we're doing, most investors will have a watch list, either formally or informally, of businesses they kind of would love to own, but the shares are just too expensive. And there's stuff you never own anyway, right? That's as you discard. Other ones you're like, oh, gee, I tell you, if that company got low enough, I'd definitely buy shares because I love the business and I would love to own it, but gee, I can't buy it now. If they got cheaper, I'd buy them. Mm. And so Troy's just saying, hey, if the market fell 20%, where would you go shopping? What would you be looking out for? What would be on the market crash watch list of buy ideas? And I just thought it was a really, really clever way to ask the question. I think I love my boss, Tom Gardner, and he's a great man. And if he wants to give me a bonus, he's welcome to. I actually think Tori's question is better, Tom, sorry, because that's, for my mind, I wouldn't have sold anything. But hey, if the all odds wake up tomorrow morning and the market crashes, what would I buy more of? What's on the shopping list? Mm. What's on your shopping list, Ray?
Well, it's hard because I would suspect if the market fell 20%, I dare say a lot of the companies that I'm interested in would probably fall a lot more because they tend to be smaller and they tend to have what they call a higher beta, so they're much more volatile than the market. So, the market overall could fall 20%, but these ones could fall potentially more or even less in some cases. So again, it's got to be a stock specific question. And then there are companies out there, ProMedic is a good example. I think it's one of the best businesses on the ASX. I just think it's phenomenal. But I'd actually think, and I probably would buy some more if it went down 20%, but I do consider it very overvalued. I actually think it would need to fall more than that for it to become super attractive. It got to $15 in the COVID crash, by the way, which I was very happy to take advantage of.
Wow.
It's up fourfold since then. Happy days, right? But I'd probably need to see it fall a lot more. So I'll probably answer it in a slightly different way and sort of say, what do I think are some of the highest quality companies on the ASX? And I'd be comparing that, what they happen to fall against, what my independent notion of value was. So I'd put ProMedicus in there, but geez, I'd love to buy some CSL shares if the market had a big fall. Xero, Cochlear, Technology One, I'll avoid some of the more micro cap stocks that I know.
Throw a couple in if you want.
Yeah. But they would fall so much more. They would fall a lot. But I think all of those are just rock solid businesses that you know are going to be around in 10 years' time, going to be worth much more. And I'd also know that after it fell, I would buy some and then it would fall in half again because that's just what happens. So
what happens.
But there are a few names, and in the smaller cap end, I mean, again, it's the ones I always go on about. I like EnviroSuite, like Catapult, like Jumbo, like Ava Risk Group, bought some more of them recently. I think Nanosonics is a fantastic business. Cogstate's super interesting. I'm just going through the list I've got here on Strawman. XRF Scientific, you wouldn't have heard a lot of these businesses, but they're actually under the radar businesses, but very attractive ones. And yeah, they would be in my shopping list. So one of the things, and this is not a plug, but one of the things, the way we designed Strawman was the idea is you sort of put you write up an investment thesis, you can post a valuation, then you can set a price alert. So every time I sort of do a bit of research or look at a company, I'll write something up and I go, oh, I really like this. I'd buy it at this price and I'd set a price alert. And then I just go about my merry way. And then one day, ding, it's gotten to the price I said I would buy it at if it got to there. And that sort of is my prompt there rather than looking at what the overall market has kind of done. Now, maybe something has changed and I need to go back and redraft up what I thought because the facts have changed. Right. But if nothing has, then that is a wonderful reminder. And it's just, again, nothing about Strawman, just in general, grab a piece of paper, right? Write out your investment thesis. What do you think it's worth and when would you buy it? And then if it gets there, follow through on what you said you were going to do. It's hard. Everyone says, oh, if this got down 50%, I would buy it. Well, guess what? It's just fallen 50%. Because everyone's scared, they have pants scared off them. No one knows what's going on. And none of us do what we say we're going to do because they think, ooh, I know I said I would, but maybe I'll just wait a little bit longer.
That's so true, mate.
Or
exactly
maybe I'll wait for things to get better and then I'll do it. No, buy it. If nothing has changed except for the price, or even if things have changed a little bit and the price has changed at a much more exaggerated level, buy the damn thing. You're not trying to time it here. It's cheap. Get it, And as we just said at the beginning, if you are broadly right, you will be eventually rewarded for that, even though you may look silly for a long time, even though it may be very painful for a long time. That's how you outperform the market.
Yep.
It's a really
good answer. Well, yeah, so I'm going to take a different slant to your answer, but it's kind of the same vibe. The challenge with this question is, and most people will say, the ones I want to buy, to your point about CSL, the ones I want to, I'd love to get those quality business when they're on sale. And that's true. All else being equal, if someone walked into my office, such as this, in the morning and said, hey, CSL's on sale for $25. You want to buy some? I'm like, yes, I will. And I will mortgage my house and buy the CSL shares at $25 because they're 200 and something, whatever they are now. Yes, absolutely. The challenge is that, as you already said, Ram, in a market where CSL is down 20%, something else is down 30 or 40%. And so while you say, well, this is a wonderful business and I'd love to buy it at $30, if and when it gets there, it may not be the best thing to buy. And at that point in time, the companies you might want to buy are the ones that have the best upside from that point.
Yes.
So while you may never get a chance to buy the high quality businesses at that price, I mean, you can buy them anyway if you want to, but you know, it's not like that they fall in a vacuum and the other stuff doesn't. So, you know, a really easy example is one I know you've looked at in the past, we talked about before, is AP Eagers, the car business, right? When we go through an economic cycle that causes a stock market crash, and it'll happen, or just a slump or a decline or whatever, because the economy starts to falter a little bit, new car sales will fall through the floor. And those shares could be down 50, 60, 70% from top to bottom, right? And so right then, do you want to buy Woolies at a 10% discount or Eagers at a 70% discount?
Mm.
And you were saying that was your point, mate, about, you know, some of the companies, the small caps you own, but just because they're small will fall further. And then there's those that are exposed to the economy or the reason that crash happens, who are going to fall even further because people freak out. Now, sometimes those businesses may not have enough cash to make it through. So I'm not saying every business that falls a lot is worth buying, but you mentioned ProMedica's down to $15, fell by... must have been, what, 75%? Something fell, like that from the sound?
Yeah, fell a lot. Yeah.
When the market fell 37%. So again, you know, do you want to buy CSL when CSL falls 20%, when the market falls 37? Or do you want to buy ProMedica's down two-thirds, three-quarters, and then goes back up? And so that's a really difficult one, is the time you think you're going to be able to buy those quality businesses on sale. And you can, but they're not the best ideas now because they're too expensive. And they're not going to be the best ideas then because the market's going to fall even further. Mm. And so... honestly, I would go shopping for, in a general market slump caused by economics, assuming that the patterns follow from the past, I'd be going shopping for discretionary retailers.
Mm.
In terms of like pure upside from that point, if you can buy Harvey Norman, JB Hi-Fi, Premier Investments, I own Harvey Norman for the record. What else is there, mate? You know, those are screaming. They're the ones are going to get absolutely smashed.
Yeah.
Right? Now, you've got to be careful they're not going to go broke, as I said. So don't buy every one of them. Mosaic Brands had to raise capital during the COVID slump because they had their stores closed while others sold online. So there are very different businesses with very different attributes. Accent is one business. Ascent, sorry. What's the other one? Adairs, potentially, right? I would, that honestly, that's the first place I'd go because they're going to get smashed, or in theory, and if they don't, but I buy them by the way, but if they get smashed, they're going to give you much better potential long-term returns than buying Woolies at a 20% discount. Eagers itself, I'd probably consider buying depending on what happened to the market and where the shares were. So I would absolutely go bargain hunting at that point, not just trying to buy stuff that was a little bit of a discount.
I think that's true. Although the trick with that is, because you're not buying these companies because you think they're great, necessarily the best businesses out there. You're just buying them because the best upside there. Now, if that is realized, and it probably will be, it also means that you've got to adjust with the new reality. So once that panic has gone out of it, you're left with a mediocre company at a fair price.
Correct.
And so I think what a lot of people do is they go, it's not the best business in the world, but it's super cheap. I'm buying it. Yeah. And then 5 years later, they're still holding it after that's played out. It's kind of like,
I've got not the best business in the world. It's not cheap anymore.
Yeah. I'm not advocating trading in and out or doing anything like this, but it's just the reason that you bought it has changed. The reason that you bought it will probably be the very different reason for why you continue to hold it once that fear discount is gone. Totally. Now, what Troy's getting at, I would imagine, is he's saying, well, if I'm going to buy something that actually I am happy to hold for years and years and years and years and years, that is a different question. Yeah. And this is, the old Buffett saying, it's better to have a great company at a fair price than a fair company at a great price. And so again, lots of nuance in all of that and lots of it depends in all of that, but that's the true answer. And so I think you're right, Troy. I think it's worth having that wish list of really high quality businesses. But I would layer on top of what you said, Scott, which is you may find that in certain situations, particularly in massive market dislocations, they may not actually be the ones that offer the best medium term upside. And it's a trade-off, as it always is. So yeah, just bear in mind when you're buying it, what's the thesis? And what and once on one hand with the high quality business, the thesis is just going to continue to kick goals and I want to keep this in the bottom drawer and compound my money over a very long time. And then the other thesis is, well, it's an okay company, it's just stupid cheap, and at some point that will rectify itself and then I'll take my money out. Two equally valid but different approaches, and you just have to have a very clear head as to what trade you're actually making there and make sure that you stay consistent with that, because what we all do is that we rationalize things. We buy for one reason and then we end up holding for a very different one.
That is so true. The whole thesis creep thing is so prevalent. If you want, but to your point, Matt, and to Troy's point, if the question was, you know, which long-term business would I buy? I'd love to buy Salt Pats at $20.
Oh, yeah.
I'd happily buy Woolworths at $30. That's your point about having a price, right? Yep. What's that? These are arbitrary price, right? I don't have a DCF anywhere with this is what Salt Pats is worth. But if you get a chance, if you want to buy, even honestly, mate, the NASDAQ ETF.
Yeah.
If the NASDAQ falls out of bed, I'd happily just buy the ETF and go, you know what? It'll recover and those companies will do great things and these are super high quality businesses. Let's get on with it. Mm. Again, makes super huge amounts of sense to go and grab some of those businesses.
Yep.
I think there's some great companies you can buy at really good prices. But again, knowing your thesis, knowing your investment style, knowing your desire and how you want to think about some of that stuff, that's absolutely part of the conversation.
Yep.
Motley Fool Money. For more, subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener.
Let's go to a question from PPA on Twitter. Scott, curious for one of your shows if you can discuss overseas investing and currency fluctuation considerations. E.g., buy a US company at $100 a share when the dollar is 75 US cents, share price goes up, but the AUD drops, what happens? Not that I'm short term, but it can still affect the value at the time of sale, I assume. Is this correct? And he's absolutely right. When you're buying Australian companies, you deal with the share price. But you're buying and selling in Australian dollars, you're living in Australian dollars, the currency doesn't matter, at least to the sale price. I know you're going to tell me there's other ways the currency matters, Andrew. I can see you smiling already. if you buy a US company or an overseas company at all, you're buying at a price and a currency exchange rate. You're selling at a price and a currency exchange rate, and they both matter in terms of the return you get. By the way, also the tax you pay, even if you don't transfer those dollars back to Australia. So there are important tax and share price considerations or total return considerations, I should say. And you're absolutely right, PPA, that the currency moves do matter. Don't they, Andrew?
Yeah. They do. But they don't matter as much.
Tell us why.
So while you were talking, I was furiously sort of trying to Google a long-term chart between the AUD and the US dollar. And this one goes back to 2006, just on Yahoo Finance.
Nice.
So all the way back in June of 2006, we were at about 75 cents a share. where we are at the moment. Now, it got up to $1.10.
So 75 cents to the US dollar, so 75 cents per share, which was impressive, but not quite right.
So it's kind of gone nowhere except it hasn't. Yeah. The way, it got down to like low 60s, I want to say, maybe even below. This chart is a very bad chart here, but it got to $1.10 in between. Mm-hmm. So they are absolutely having an impact. But the thing is with currency is it's not going to continue. It's not as though the Aussie dollar is going to forever grow against the US dollar. It can't for various complicated reasons. But earnings can continue to go up and up and up.
In horrible, horrible economic circumstances.
Well, if the US the US collapses, okay. But then there's a whole bunch of other things to sort of worry about.
Right.
So when I look, I'm a long-term investor. What's the word for it? Long-term investor, investor is by definition long-term. Anything
tautology,
else is thank you. Tautology is the word I'm looking for. But as a long-term investor, when I'm looking out 5 years and let's say I'm investing in some US stocks, What is the currency going to be there? I don't know. Mm-hmm. But it's probably unlikely to be, you know, 55 cents. It's probably it's very likely to be somewhere between 55 and $1.10, say, mm-hmm. you know, something like that. Yep. And that's yep. going, that's definitely going to have an impact and potentially a sizable one. But if I'm right. investing in NVIDIA mm-hmm. or I'm trying to think of non-typical ones, you know, Netflix or some of these other kind of ones mm-hmm. whose earnings mm-hmm. are growing at 20%, you sort of got these two factors that are having an impact on the share price. It's just that one is far, 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 far more dominant. So you and I can have both have a car. Mine has a huge engine in it. It's just, I've got a V12 engine in this thing, but I'm not very aerodynamic. You have something that's been optimized in a wind tunnel, right?
And, I am so slick.
You know, and you just, the air just slips past you like a hot butter through, like a knife through hot butter. But you've got like a lawnmower engine in there. So is wind resistance important to speed? Yeah, it's really important to speed. But it's not as important as me with my V12 engine that's driving a brick. I'm just going to beat you every day of the week. And that's the way that I like to think about it.
It's a great analogy.
You know, so it's sort of like go for something that has the really strong – I mean, ideally have one that, you know, is a really good engine and aerodynamically sound. But I'm going to focus on the engine. I'm not going to focus on some other factors that, while influential – are so secondary in their impact as to not be overly concerned about. And people can try and have their cake and eat it too and just say, oh, well, I'm just going to hedge. Well, if you'd hedged over since 2006, you've spent a bunch of money to go nowhere and it's just dampened your returns as it's turned out. So yeah, it's a factor, but don't overthink it. What is far more important is to make sure you've got a very high quality growing company in there, and then the currency is going to be a bit of a rounding error in the fullness of time, to my mind.
I think that's right. As long as you have enough time, and it's a bit like, again, the only caveat I'd add to your answer, mate, is it depends what sort of companies you're investing in and what sort of returns they're going to get, right? Because, and frankly, how could you aren't investing, but that's the same in any company. And the longer the term, as you say, because by definition, the dollars kind of have to fluctuate between two relatively fixed points, whereas the share price can grow forever. The more growth you get and the longer you own the shares, and those two are obviously related, the less time that the currency matters. Yep. So, you know, if you'd have bought Berkshire at $50 a share and it's now $200,000 a share, trust me, the currency doesn't matter to your return, right? No. It just doesn't matter. Now, if you buy, I don't know, Walmart at $50 a share and now it's $60 a share and it's been 3 years and the dollar's depreciated by 20% in the meantime, that's going to get pretty close, right? And so, say Walmart's a bad investment or you shouldn't have made it or whatever. Just recognize that the time frame and the compound returns, you know, the longer you hold, the more your return, the less currency matters, as you say, Ram, because it does fluctuate.
Yep.
Now, $1.15 versus 45 cents. That's still that's a really, really, really big chunk of change. So I would absolutely say when I buy and when I sell US shares, I do absolutely think about the times I want to transfer money between the two countries. It makes perfect sense, right? So if the dollar is $1.15, I'm going to throw as much money as I can into the US market. When the dollar's 45 cents, I'm possibly going to think about selling some of my companies and moving them back to Australia because think about if the dollar, let's say dollars, make my life easier, right? Let's say dollar's a dollar a parity. If it falls to 50 cents, you're doubling your money, right? It's the equivalent of saying, hey, if you owned a share, let's say you own Woolies and you bought it at $40, it goes to 80 all of a sudden for no good reason. Do you hold it just because it's currency, not share price? I don't think you do. So there are times when I would say, you know what, I'm going to take my money and I'm going to run because, by the way, when the dollar goes back to 70 or 75 cents, I can always buy back if I want. And not because I'm a trader and not because I'm whatever, just because if someone offers you a stupid share price, sell your shares. Like, don't hold just because if I own Woolies and I think long-term it's going to be a great investment, someone overnight says, you know, first thing tomorrow morning, do you want $100 for your Woolies shares? I'm like, no, I'm a long-term investor and I think eventually it'll be worth $120 in 7 years' time. So I'm going to hold them. It's like, no, take the money now. If someone offers you a stupid price to buy or sell, take the damn money. Yeah. Doesn't mean you can't reinvest some other point. And you don't have, just because you're a long-term investor doesn't mean you can't simply go, oh man, that's too good to refuse. Yeah. I plan to be here forever, but I'll take the money.
Yep.
So do that. That's my only caveat, mate. Is that fair?
Totally fair. Totally fair.
Nice. Let's move on. Hi, Scott. I heard recently that 10% of Redbubble shares were being shorted. I just want to know how this is public information and how you can find out. He says it would be interesting to see for my current holdings. Love listening to you and Ram on the pod. And that's from Lucas. Thank you, mate. Good question. Ram. shorting?
Yeah.
Redbubble. How do you find out? Does it matter? Do you care?
Not really. It's the second most shorted stock on the ASX. And I'm sure there's other services out there and there's no affiliation, so I'm not promoting it. But I know there's one called shortman.com.au.
That's what everyone uses.
And that'll list it all for you for free. Does it matter? I don't know. Shorters have had a woeful time of late. We've talked about this before. For some reason, shorting seems smarter. So, if someone releases a short thesis, it really scares the pants off the market. Someone releases a long thesis saying, "Oh, I really like this company," it doesn't seem to have the same effect. And we can all point to examples of where it's worked out. This is the beauty of the market. It's an example to prove any point you want. But I don't know if statistically there's any reason to believe that the people on the short side are any smarter than the people on the long side and that they have any particular track record. There's some wonderful examples of companies that were massively, people were hugely short on, and all the shorters got burnt, and it didn't mean anything at all. So I've always said that I think it's an interesting point. I think when you notice something like Redbubble that is massively short, the question you want to ask is, oh my God, well, what's the short thesis? What am I missing here? Maybe they're right, but I want to know what it is.
Yeah.
I actually dug into this recently with Redbubble, and it's interesting because on a lot of ways, this business is just knocking it out of the park. So it feels as though to me that the likely short thesis here is one of valuation, which to me is always a very bad short bet. If you're going to bet, you can only double your money going short, right?
Yeah,
it can only go to zero. So I think it makes more sense to go short when you think this is a fraud. Mm-hmm. This is how John Hempton does it, right? He looks for frauds because he thinks that they'll go to zero. If you think something's 20% overvalued and you go short, that is a tough bet. Because one, even if you're right, it might take ages before the market agrees with you. And then even if you are, your upside's pretty capped. And, look at all the people betting short on Tesla. Some really great these weren't idiots and they had some really solid arguments for it. But so far, massively, massively wrong. And in investing, there's this saying that being early is indistinguishable for being wrong. I don't like it. On the long side, I think that's actually less of a factor because as we were talking about recently, it's just like you can go sideways for 5 years and then 10x from there. You're still going to do very, very, very well. And being early, there is no problem with that. But in shorting, it is everything. If you're early, you are wrong, 100% wrong because there's a cost of carry as well with all of that kind of stuff. So I guess let's tie it in a bow. What I'm saying here is that I would avoid making the assumption that the shorters are always right because they're not.
Mm-hmm.
But I would certainly, I think it's an interesting data point and I would want to know what they're thinking that so many people have thought enough of it that it's a factor. But then it's a question of asking, well, what is that short thesis and do I think they're right? You have to have variant perception, maybe you're right and they're wrong. And there's lots of examples of that too. So yeah, take a look at it, but just don't make that next step of assuming that they're right because they're often not.
Yeah, fear is such a driving motivator, right? When and this is why I've said before if I was up to me, I'd ban short selling, and that makes John and other people grumpy with me, and I'm okay with that. But no, I don't. I think John's great, by the way. I like him a lot. There are some activist short sellers. I say activist almost in air quotes, and there are other words I can use. Again, I'm specifically not talking about John, who's decent and does most of his stuff behind the scenes and just bases on frauds and other things. There are others who try and create the outcome they're looking for with negative articles and all that kind of stuff, and I think that's just kind of crappy. And when I say that, people say, well, you guys are long. You say you like ProMedica, so you like Kogan, or you like Amazon, drink. And you're the same as them. The challenge we know is that when I say I like Kogan, nobody cares, and maybe three people buy the shares and it goes up 1 cent, right? When someone released a short case on what was the big
corporate
one?
Travel?
I was actually thinking of
Nearmap.
No, God, I've lost it. The freight business. Why can't I not think?
WiseTech.
There you go. Thank you, WiseTech.
Yes,
The shares fall 40%, and so that to my mind that and. When I say I like Kogan, maybe people buy it, maybe they don't. Maybe the share price goes up, maybe it doesn't. People get scared out of a stock like WiseTech at the 40% decline because they think the short sellers must know something. That's the bit that annoys me about the idea, and particularly when they're arguably, I won't say about WiseTech because I don't know who it was, I can't remember who it was, and I'm not going to get myself in trouble with anybody. But when some short sellers make a case that is largely, I'm going to say troublemaking or deliberately muddying the waters or trying to create a certain outcome, They get to do it because we as humans respond very differently to fear than we do to greed, to the risk of loss rather than the risk of gain. So I think that's absolutely right.
In case of point, WiseTech's at an all-time high.
There you go.
And it dropped, massively on the... Now, again, maybe the market's wrong now. You know, maybe this, this is the problem with shorting. Maybe they're still absolutely right, but
Well, if you held the shorts, that right, you're still holding, waiting for the market to realize you're right, and you're paying interest every time. By the way, and your ups, your downside is unlimited. When you're shorting, it's the opposite of owning shares. So there you go, mate. A follow-up question from Jamie actually that we received a little while ago. A few weeks ago, this was a couple months ago, a few weeks ago, Ram mentioned ignoring short cases against companies, which you've just done. That reminded me to ask this question. As someone who copped a big punch in the face when Glaucus presented their case against Blue Sky Alternatives, what are some warning signs I can look for in the future? I haven't been able to bring myself to pick individual stocks since, but I want to get back in the game. Also, I love the Borg reference. Cheers, Jamie. I do like a Star Trek reference. I would have mentioned the Borg at some point. It's a really good question, mate, because that's the flip side, right? Jamie, this is one that the shorters seem to have been right about. Blue Sky Alternatives did fall through the floor. I don't know what it is now. I haven't looked. It's a tough one, right? And that's the other thing. Shorters aren't always wrong. So it's a tough way to make a buck, but they're right some of the time, maybe even most of the time. Not sure how frequently. But if they're right, you kind of go, oh, my God, if that happens again, I'm really in trouble. And that short case absolutely did speed up the decline, which was possibly, I won't say anything more than that because I don't get myself in trouble with anybody, including people on both sides of that trade. Maybe it did speed up something that was inevitable anyway. And so was it the short case, was it Glaucus, or was it the fact they found something that was actually overvalued? Arguable that it is the case. But Jamie's saying, well, hang on, you know, when it does happen, then should I have known, could I have known, how can I avoid it in the future?
Yeah. We sort of in a roundabout way touched on this off air earlier, which is it's this idea that investors get out there, they make a bunch of different investments and some of them go really bad and they go, oh, this is really sucky. But it's unavoidable. Like I feel as though people have a really bad experience with a share and then throw their hands up and walk away. And it's like, well, that's everyone. I mean, welcome to the party. The height of arrogance is to think that you're going to have 100% strike rate. It doesn't exist. No one is. Buffett's never got even close to that. You know, Peter Lynch says, if you're right 6 times out of 10, you're good in this game. And he's right. He's right.
Yes, he is.
So I would implore you to, in this situation, go, yeah, that's a sucky experience. But A, what matters is your overall returns. B, it was also why you were potentially wrong here. Did you miss something? Did you double down because you thought that they were wrong? I mean, it's just, there's nothing wrong with being wrong. It's inevitable. Whereas the mistake is made in ignoring the fact that you're wrong. When you come, you should be able to have this ability to look at things objectively in a new light, regardless of what I thought yesterday, regardless of what I was. Does that still hold water? Or do I just not know? And this happens to me all the time, in a situation where I just don't know. That's Redbubble for me, by the way. I actually think it's really interesting, but then, yeah, I can kind of see some of the negatives on it as well. And so I don't have a firm view that it's great or it's bad. I just don't know. And that's that's a wonderfully powerful thing to admit to yourself, because if you don't know, or you never know for sure, but if you don't have any reasonable conviction, get the hell out. You don't have to have a firm view on everything, but you do have to know. It's that idea of where's your circle of, the size of your circle of competence isn't what matters, but knowing where the boundaries are is vitally important. So it's kind of related, right? So I guess let me summarize. If you've had a bad experience, yes, I feel for you, but don't be surprised by it. You're going to have many, many more bad experiences. If you can't form a reasonable view on if you can't have any conviction after that, then that's reason enough to sell out, even if it turns out that you would have been better off holding. That's okay too. Never invest on hope alone. Hope is a bad investment strategy, as I like to say. Roll with the punches. Expect it to happen. Just make sure that you're able to come back and reevaluate in an objective way and admit to yourself when you don't know, and because you won't. And if that's okay, and that's okay. That's perfectly okay. Move on. Take the loss and move on and just keep doing. This is a game of probability. And, you know, if you're someone who can pick horses right 6 times out of 10 or even 3 times out of 10, but the ones you get right are the ones that are paying 100 to 1, you know, this is the way that the best poker players in the world just play on the odds. They don't win every hand. They don't even get close to winning every hand.
Exactly.
You know, but they win overall because they know that when I've got four aces, that's not a guaranteed win.
Right, exactly.
Not guaranteed, but geez, the odds are in my favor, and that's how you have to think about investing. I would say it's a game of probabilities, and any game of probabilities, you're not going to win all the time.
I like it, mate. We're probably out of time almost, but I have to ask you about Bitcoin because I told you I would, and I told our listeners I would, and I'm just feeling grumpy now because we've taken too long to answer the other questions, but I have to get back to this one.
Okay,
I said I would. Hi, Scott, says Troy. Question mainly for Rampage. Isn't the thesis of Bitcoin broken? Yes, it is, Troy. Thank you. That's all we have time for. No,
in what way?
He says it was developed as a peer-to-peer payments platform.
Yeah.
Now it's a store of wealth. Also, wouldn't the bear case be that just government could outlaw and introduce their own currency? I see the Web 3.0 angle, but I see Bitcoin as web gold. Not that many uses for it and only worth what people feel like. I've done a little review on it. I've also listened to Rule Breakers podcast on this. I probably see Ethereum being a better option as it is blockchain-based network with a currency attached. Well, you're right about Bitcoin, Troy. You're still wrong about Ethereum, and that's all we have time for. Is he right, mate? Isn't this thesis creep we just mentioned before for Bitcoin, the whole, it's a currency? Well, okay, no, it's not really because it's too high. Okay, let's call it a store of value. Well, this is kind of gold, and it is because it is. Yeah. Is it really? Does it have a thing? Isn't the thesis broken?
Well, my thesis was never that it's going to be a currency. So for me, it's not changed. It's all the same technology. In fact, the new upgrade that's happening with Bitcoin will actually give it a lot more ability to compete, in fact, head-to-head with Ethereum. It's all the same stuff. It's just how you want to use it. So, no, I don't think it is broken, and I don't think I'm right just because it happens to be at a record high. I just...
He throws it in passing.
Well, I don't. I mean, but I had a few messages from mates. Oh, you must be doing victory lap. No, not really. Yep. I never knew what it was going to do when I started to buy it. And I couldn't tell you where it was going to be at this exact point in time. The thesis. I won't repeat myself. I'll just go listen to last week's episode because that's where I laid out the thesis.
Thank you.
And I think that is still intact. And the markers for me are increasing nodes on the network, increasing adoption. As long as that continues to happen, I think the thesis is in track. And I think all of those things are true. I think that the size of the network is growing. I think that the protocol that it's running on is continually getting better and better. I think it has a very strong network effect. I think people are finding it. There's more legitimacy in it just because people think there's legitimacy in it. And that sounds stupid, but welcome to fiat and gold. And that's that's true of all of these things. So yes, it's kind of silly, but that's humans.
You know, someone's bought the. You know, someone drank the Kool-Aid when they start referring to not normal currency as fiat, as if it's somehow different.
Yeah, it's all based on trust, you know. And so now people are saying, well, rather than trusting any. Well, here's the other thing that I think we miss so much nuance on it. Like the people with laser beam eyes on Twitter and stuff who are just like massively. into this, just like
it's gonna be
the new currency. There's not a black and white thing. I think it can live along. I think fiat is around for a long time, you know, decades and decades, if not centuries. So I don't think it's a replacement. I don't think that any of these things. But is it an evolving and more legitimate asset class? Yeah, I think it is. And I dare suspect that more broadly. It's a mental shift here because we're putting our trust in code. We've never done that before, and that's a huge mental shift. But I think as the mentality changes, not just in terms of what that might mean for currency, which is a very, very narrow use case of blockchain technology, smart contracts, decentralized autonomous organizations, non-fungible tokens. I mean, 99% of this area is all bubble that's going to zero. It absolutely is. But in terms of what it promises as a technology and what it can do, I think it's absolutely that. I tweeted something. I saw it the other day and I retweeted it. There was this interview with Bill Gates and David Letterman in 1995. And David Letterman is just giving Bill Gates heaps like, why would I use this internet thing? Right? It just, I don't get it. Can't I? Have you heard of radio? You know, it's just like, Bill Gates, oh, you can listen to your favorite baseball game. It's like, well, I can do that anyway. And it just, it's laughable now.
Remember real player just quietly?
Yeah. It was everything that Bill was talking, he's two interesting things. Everything that he was saying kind of came true. But also, it was also beside the point. The internet, as first imagined, was just let's put magazines online. I can go there and I can read something on someone's homepage or the news or something. And then, and what we've since used the internet for is vastly, no one, even someone like Bill Gates, who was right at the bleeding edge of this, completely missed the significance. And I dare say that with Web 3.0, which is a long time away before it becomes anything real, anything material, I think none of us can really imagine how it's sort of going there. But this technology is legitimate. It is here, and it has the potential to revolutionize a lot of things. Doesn't mean that everything gets thrown in the bin and we just all go to that. That's dumb, narrow, black and white thinking. But as something that is new and genuinely valuable and has very valid use case, even with what we can imagine, let alone what we can't imagine, I just think it's massive. So I listen to last week and you can get into more detail there, but I don't think it's broken at all.
Nice, I like it. I should say, just funnily enough too, you're speaking about Bill Gates on Letterman, Tom and David Gardner, our co-founders, were on daytime TV, one of the Oprah type shows, defending the fact people would actually use credit cards on the internet.
Yeah.
Surely no one's ever going to use a credit card on the internet. David, Tom are like, no, they will.
Yep.
No, they won't. No one's going to use a credit card on the internet, and here we are.
Yep.
All right, mate, one last one. It's got to be on Bitcoin. Same topic. Let's get out of the way now. We're on a bit longer today, and then thank God it'll be over and I can roll that rucks. From Patrick. Hi, Scott. Sorry, a follow-up question for Andrew on crypto.
Oh, dear.
See, Patrick, at least there's some sympathy. Thanks for answering my question about crypto, he says. I thought it was a very good synthesis of the crypts in general. I'm not sure if that's a typo or that's what the cool kid called. Is that the plural for crypto? Is it crypts?
Or
is
it just, works for me. The yeah, no, I get
all
it.
All right, in general. And your thesis for investing, as I said, I own a few myself, so I tend to agree with what you said. We all love confirmation bias, Patrick. However, there is one thing I still don't get, and that is valuation and market cap, e.g.
Yeah.
Bitcoin is at $1.2 trillion. Mm. How do you conceptualize or think about the total market cap when looking at valuation, or is this something you simply don't bother about? That's a good question.
This is the last question. I'm going to answer this one quickly. This is hard. This is really hard. It's not a business. A company, we just can talk about cash flows and that. There's no cash flows here. Mm. So that's really hard to value. And then it comes back more fundamentally to what is value. Then now we're going to get into the realm of philosophy. I don't know. You know, it's hard.
Oh, I'm sorry. You know, Patrick, this is your fault. You're
well, it kind of is. So it's sort of like, does Wikipedia have value? They don't make any money. They're funded on things. It definitely got value there. How do you value that though? That's a really interesting question.
Right.
How do you value the local fire service? You know, someone's paying money for that thing. God knows it doesn't make a money. It just bleeds cash. It's not any kind. But does the AMBO service, does the firefighting service have value? Yes, it does. And so the broad argument here for me is that whether it's something that's becoming a more legitimate store of value, whether it's something that's more legitimately underpinning a lot of the stuff that's going to be done in Web 3.0, I actually don't know what the value is, but I do know that if this does gain any widespread adoption, that almost by definition, the value has to be significantly more than what it is. Significantly more. So if the entire, well, not the entire, let's say a significant portion of the internet does transition to this Web 3.0 framework, by definition, it has to have more value. Significantly more value, and that's the bet. So I would never make it it's not a question of I think it's worth $97,500 and it's now at $92,000 per Bitcoin, therefore it's cheap. It's more a question of if this transitions to something that is increasingly seen by institutions, organizations, big family offices, it's kind of going that way, and it becomes more widespread, then yeah, I think it has to have not just a bit more value, but significantly more value. Can I just say too, for the record, the vast majority of my money is in stocks, right? I feel as though I get painted as this crypto. I think it's a fascinating space, and I think sensible people can have a sensible view on it and a sensible exposure to it if they're going in with the right attitude, with the right expectations. It's not about... It's like so many things. It's not all in or nothing. There's a lot of middle ground. There's a long spectrum to be had there. And it's a very broad conversation. There's so much to get into, but that's my short answer anyway.
I just think it's amazing that when I say, what's a share price worth, you say $2.50. And when I ask what Bitcoin's worth, you say, well, what's value anyway? there's an interesting distinction between those two concepts. You don't ask me about the ambulance service when I ask you what you should pay for Woolworths shares, but you're happy to dissemble and point to philosophical questions when it comes to Bitcoin.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is interesting, is all I'm saying.
It's hard. It's very hard.
I like it. Mate, just one really quick follow-up, because you asked about the market cap. Do you know, do you care? I mean, a lot of people say Bitcoin is worth X, and they try and evaluate at a system level to make a case. And I guess that might be what Patrick's talking about here, when people say, well, it's worth this, either in a good way, hey, look how much it's worth, or it's not worth much because it's only worth this, and the market, stock market's worth that, or currency's worth that. People use it as a relative measure. Am I right from your answer to assume, and not to extend it for the sake of it, just to try and get the number of Patrick's question, am I right to say you kind of don't care so much because it's either worth a quantum more or a whole lot less, but probably not the current value? I mean, is that kind of the point? Or, you know, if it was, you know, it's 1.2 trillion, apparently, according to Patrick, I'll take him at the word.
Yeah, it's about that.
If it was half a trillion or 20 trillion or 200 trillion or a gazillion, whatever the next thing is, do you care what the system
value, I think so. It matters.
Thing is worth?
Yeah, definitely. Okay. I mean, I know I've given this example before and it's an old one, but it's just, it's probably the easiest way of looking at it. But let's take every single ounce of gold that's ever been mined, and let's times that by the current price per ounce, and we've got a market cap for gold, right? Yep. And that's the sort of the historic store of value.
Does it matter though? I mean, no one really ever says, no one ever used the market cap of gold before now to make a case for buying or selling it, right? I guess that's why I'm not saying you're wrong too. I'm just, given Patrick's question, he's asking, hey, there is this, people are talking about it as a market cap, I think mostly the pro Bitcoin people are talking about the size of it, somehow that's justified for some reason. No one ever bought or sold gold based on the total combined value of gold in existence.
Yeah.
Not that they were wrong. They might have been wrong as well. You guys might be right. But it's just interesting that it's becoming part of the case for, or sometimes against, Bitcoin. It wasn't with gold. Does it matter? Is it because it's kind of part currency that people talk about market cap, or are they making the case?
I just think it's interesting to draw that analogy, because if your argument is it becomes a more widespread adopted legitimate store of value, it gives you something to peg it against. It's just as made up. But if someone sort of comes up with something that says it's going to be worth 1,000 times more than the total market cap of gold, it's like, well, that's kind of how. Very hard. But when you get to a point where it's kind of like, actually, I don't know what it is at this point in time, but if it's significantly below that, it's got a long way to run if that initial thesis proves correct. That is, that it does go much wider spread. So it's an interesting way to sort of to look at it at that point. Mm. I mean, the real what you've got here is you've got a bit of a token that if I put in, I feel as though that I'll be able to get so much out at the end of the day. And if enough people think that and there's enough value in that, then maybe you can detach it a little bit from that. If it serves its purpose in that particular use case, then it can be pretty much arbitrary, as long as I feel as though there's not going to be too much fluctuation in that. And I'm talking about more at an end stage here, not in the adoption growth phase. But it's a fascinating thing. I think if you're someone who is going into this space and you buy something and just because you got super lucky it's worth 5x from today, I think that'd be a really silly thing to sell. If everything else is, and if your fundamental reason for buying it is still continuing to play out, because... it's sort of, you're missing the point here. This isn't something that you can, any sensible person can have. There are more complex ways, and we just don't have time to dig into it. And you get all kinds of different valuation. But this,
thank God, I mean, that's a shame.
But this is true. Like, you take Morgan Stanley and take UBS, and they'll both publish a valuation for BHP, and they could be 30% different. Now, they both have the same information. They both have incredibly smart, well-credentialed, well-trained people, and yet they come up with vastly different answers. Which one's right? Well, maybe neither of them right. I don't know. And it's sort of like that times 1,000 on Bitcoin. So it's very, 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 very difficult. But that's why I try and draw back from that. And it's more about just saying, this thing has value in its given use case. If that use case increases, and you will by definition see that being represented in the price over time. And I think the potential for that to be, you know, is this 10% undervalued, 20%? No, if that happens, we're probably looking at something that's far, 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 far more significant than that. And that's why I'm sort of happy to have a small exposure to it. Does that make sense? Nice. I don't know.
Yes. No,
it's hard to do quickly.
It absolutely does.
Yeah.
It absolutely does. It absolutely does. Yes, it does. We did have one correspondent too who we talked about the Bitcoin ETF or crypto ETF, who made the point that it was actually an ETF with crypto related companies in it. Was a new one apparently being launched. I made the kind of just general speculation about an ETF of cryptos would see more money chasing the same number of assets and should push prices up, and you kind of agreed with that.
Yeah.
And the correspondent was saying, the new ETF is just going to be companies.
Yeah.
I actually agree. I wasn't talking about that particular ETF, or if I accidentally did link the two together, I didn't mean to. There will be cryptocurrency ETFs sooner rather than later. Mm. Not that particular one, which is about companies that deal with cryptocurrency, which, by the way, if I was going to do it, I would actually do something like that. I think you can get some of the upside of the picks and shovels of crypto, particularly with businesses that already have existing, whether it's like a payment systems or tech companies like NVIDIA or something that do stuff with that sort of stuff. Anyway, just wanted to cover that as well because we got the question about it. Mate, we are well and truly done. We're over time. The good news is I left the Bitcoin stuff till the end, so people who are still here are the true believers. Everyone else got to turn off early, so that's always positive. Please do follow us on the socials. Please do send us your questions and comments. We really appreciate it. I gave you my socials, the Motley Fool socials, earlier. I didn't exclude Rams because it wasn't important, just because he doesn't normally field the mailbag questions. So they were for me. If you want to get in touch with Ram, do so at @Sage_Simeon and at Strawman Invest. You really do want to follow Andrew. You want to follow Strawman. They're doing good things in a good way.
Thanks, mate.
There are a small but important number of good guys in the space. They include Andrew and hopefully the Motley Fool. We're trying to do the right thing by people. I hope you invest better and try and do it in a pretty decent way. So follow Andrew. You should.
Cool.
Until next week, mate. Full on.
Cheers.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691. Listener.